Good morning, everyone. We're going to roll right in this morning. I'd like to convene the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources Committee to order. This morning, we have Dr. Sorensen. Dr. Sorensen, you can come down if you're ready. Dr. Peter Sorensen from the University of Minnesota has graciously adjusted his schedule to come in. Dr. Sorensen, I know you're much more comfortable standing up, and unfortunately, you were allowed to do that at LCCMR. Yeah. Nobody questioned it, but I've never allowed anybody to stand up, and I don't remember Representative Wagenius or Representative Osmond doing that either. So we can better hear the microphone. That would be great. Welcome, Dr. Sorensen. You've been involved, I know, in a lot of research around carp. This committee is very interested in Asian carp, so we'd like to hear, you've done presentations before, but we'd like to hear from you this morning for like about 15 minutes. I know that, so maybe if you can do an opening presentation, about 10 minutes, we'll have some time for questions because I know you're off to somewhere else. Welcome, Dr. Sorensen. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you're with, go
ahead.
Thank
you, Chairman. I'm Peter Sorensen, Professor of Fisheries, Wildlife, Conservation Biology at the University of Minnesota.
Go ahead, Dr. Sorensen. You've done a presentation, I know, with PowerPoint overheads.
Right.
Today, we've asked that to be shortened up. So if you could just talk a little bit about how you think this group would be able to finance some good work in the area of aquatic invasive species, specifically maybe Asian carp. And
right.
Also, if you want to touch on zebra mussel or if you want
right.
to concentrate on Asian carp. Go ahead, Dr. Sorensen.
Okay, well, thank you. I didn't really bring my presentation again, so I'll just maybe ramble a little bit, but if you want to ask questions, please do. I've been at the University of Minnesota since 1988, and in 1990, I started working on sea lamprey control. I have 16 years experience with sea lamprey control, have a patent for sea lamprey applications, which has been developed into a research center at Michigan State. And working with sea lamprey, which is one of our first and worst invasive species, I saw how a successful invasive species program can work. And that involves a long-sighted kind of science-based approach that's very systematic. So sea lamprey, some of you may know, are now controlled with a toxin. But that took 5 years of development and a long series of experiments screening almost 7,000 compounds before they hit the right one. But sea lamprey are now controlled. After working with sea lamprey, I came to focus locally on Minnesota waters where I got involved with carp. And that was particularly after a trip actually to Australia where carp, common carp, are highly invasive as well. And while visiting down there, I was struck by the fact that common carp, which we'd long given up on here, are number five in the noxious species list in Australia and part of a 40-year management plan across the country of Australia, where they were actually focusing and continue to focus all their efforts on permanent fixes, such as actually developing diseases to control carp that would permanently fix the problem, because in their opinion, anything less than that was a waste of money. And anyway, I came back to Minnesota and was graciously funded by the LCCMR for a period of 4 years, and my lab undertook the process of trying to figure out what to do about common carp, which is probably still the worst aquatic invasive actually in the state of Minnesota. It's just been here for so long. People thought nothing could be done because, like Asian carp, a single female has 1 to 3 million eggs a year. They live to be 50, 60 years old. Asian carp are also very long-lived like that. That's an important point when you're dealing with invasive species. A 2 or 3 year funding cycle is meaningless in the life of an animal that lives to be 20, 30, 40, 50 years old. By the way, the same thing's true with sea lamprey. So we started this process of just trying to understand how common carp work, which nobody had done, frankly, because people thought it was just hopeless. And my point is that as we started, my lab started to figure this out, we discovered things, such as we discovered the fact that carp, although they have 1 to 3 million years of eggs every year, most years, almost all, just maybe 1 in every 10 years do any eggs survive at all. they were actually naturally being controlled by game fish in our lakes. And we were able to pull that apart and are now starting to control carp by actually restoring wetlands, which were seriously degraded, which are the source of these young carp, and fix that. As well, we discovered that the aggregate, this took a few years, in very precise ways so that we can sometimes remove them in the summer, in the winter, and we now have control programs for that. So the lesson is the approach to invasive species, like a lot of issues, and I was going to mention briefly, like, frankly, medical science is a really complex thing. You have to take a multi-pronged approach and a long perspective. You have to look for the weaknesses, because every species has its weakness, and you have to move forward in a systematic manner and be patient. But if you do that, there's considerable potential for success at various levels. So I have proposed, frankly, a research center at the university to take that perspective, which is modeled on successful programs being run out of Australia and the Great Lakes for sea lamprey, to help address not just Asian carp, but the variety of invasive species that Minnesota now has, and frankly, unfortunately, will be getting, because they are moving up the Mississippi River from the lower part of the river, and they are moving from the Great Lakes through Duluth, and as well as through the ship canal in Michigan. So basically, I'll just overview my perspective on it, and then I
Dr.
guess...
Dr. Sorensen?
Yes.
Thank you. Excuse for interrupting. Dr. Sorensen, you specifically brought forward a proposal, and maybe I'll ask Representative Wagenius to come up now.
Yes.
And sit by you.
Fine.
If she would, because she's got a bill. But you had a bill, or you had a presentation at Lessard-Sams that identified a couple million dollars you
yes.
were looking for. What was the time frame that you wanted the couple million dollars? How long would that last for? And then Representative Wagenius can just tell us quickly then. Her bill is a little different than
it's
your $2 million proposal.
So,
Dr. Sorensen.
Specifically, my proposal was for 8 years of funding, and it had five components. Very briefly, one was to look at new detection systems for invasive species, because if you don't know where they are, like exactly where they are and how many they are, it's very difficult to do anything. New control schemes to control them, and this included a specific position for zebra mussel, which I see is a really big inadequacy right now in the state here. Somebody to look and bring new technologies in, as well as common carp. Somebody to look at developing new barrier systems that were actually designed specifically for our fishes that we are facing problems with, not a technology being brought in from somewhere else, which has been the case all along here. Also is looking for money to look for eradication schemes, particularly actually focused on new pathogens. Every species has its weakness. Every species has its diseases, to see if we could bring these in. That would be sort of the silver bullet. And also, I think very importantly, an extension position to allow the university and its research capabilities and research capabilities across the globe to be able to funnel that down to the DNR and watershed managers and so forth. So that was my proposal.
And Dr. Sorensen, you specifically had a price tag of $2 million. Was that for how long of a term was that $2 million?
So my proposal was $2 million a year for those positions I described, and we needed $2 million to get up and running. Building repairs, we need to refurbish tank systems so we can have zebra mussel in the lab and can try different toxicants.
Thank you,
like
Dr. Sorensen. So your proposal that you brought forward to Lessard-Sams was a package of $2 million a year, was that proposal. Representative Hansen has a question, then we'll go to Representative Wagenius just to lay out her bill. And members in the audience, we're having a overview of these bills as informational. We won't be voting on these bills today, but we're trying to take advantage of people availability to come and talk to us and get a feeling for it. I do believe this Asian carp situation, we're trying to work with the administration. I believe that will probably be the first bill we see back here before the committee. Representative Hackbart, Representative Wagenius have bills dealing with that, and I believe those specifically the barrier bill may be one of the first, depending on
sure.
how far we get with the Senate and the administration. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that Dr. Sorensen has to leave quickly. So my question is, there's been the federal government over the last few years has put a great emphasis on the Asian carp in Illinois. Millions of dollars, and I believe there's been a research effort. Can you maybe compare and contrast what has happened and what is needed here?
Dr. Soren,
on the research side.
Great question. Actually, that's where I was yesterday down in St. Louis at one of the Asian carp research centers down there. The work on Asian carp being funded by the federal government is, and I'm actually partially funded by them, not to a great amount, but is entirely really focused on preventing any more carp getting from the Illinois River into Lake Michigan. So that's the focus, and it particularly centers around testing for carps in the presence of Chicago Ship Canal, developing air cannons to stop them from moving that through that narrow passage that separates. This is a passage that was constructed between the Illinois River, which goes down the Mississippi, and Lake Michigan. And they don't want any to get through there. So they're developing air cannons to stop them from moving out there. They're spending millions of dollars on eDNA testing around that area. They're trying to develop some poison baits. And they're doing some basic ecology work. So none of it's really germane, directly germane to the ecology of the river systems up here or to stopping fish from moving up here preemptively. Although it's a lot of money, it's still pretty limited in some ways in scope. I hope.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius, do you want to walk through your bill just in a real quick overview? I'd actually like to wrap up Professor Sorensen's time and your bill just in the next couple minutes. But you have a bill, and if you could just give us an overview, and folks certainly will get to look at the bill and evaluate it, and we'll get to hear it again later.
Well, let's just start with, I agree with what Dr. Sorensen wants to do. And what I see is the problem is not what his proposal is, but our two-year funding cycle and how that is an impediment to getting something done like the thing he wants done. So what I want to... The mic. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I want to do is go over the practical issues of hiring what I call investigators, and I call Dr. Sorensen the FBI for invasives, because what he's trying to do is to understand his enemy so he can control it. So the practical problem is our two-year budget cycle, and it is an impediment to any kind of long-term commitment. And in this case, as he said, it's going to take a long-term commitment to find solutions. We don't do it every 2 years in a budget cycle. And we need to attract, as he was outlining, some new investigators to this state. And we're not going to get people who have are the best and brightest of the investigators to move to this state for 2 years. Just not going to pack up and come for that. So the practical solution is either to use funding from the lottery or the legacy or both. And both work well because in both we have had a history of and we commonly can set aside money for not just 1 year or 2 years, but we can set aside money for 5 years or 6 years or 8 years. He proposed eight. In my bill, I proposed six, that we set aside money for 6 years. So you will see that in my bill, the math is done based on 6 years. It's not a magic number. It's just the one I used. Because one of the things that I think we understand is that once we get new investigators in this state, new scientists in this state, and they have a track record here, there will be new opportunities for them to attract money. So my appropriation in this bill is a one-time appropriation with the expectation that the university would take over the funding after 6 years, the university in combination with getting grants from, say, the National Science Foundation or something like that. So there have been the questions of constitutionality of using lottery money and legacy money. So I want the page, if we would just hand out copies of the Constitution, and you will see what I have highlighted here. You know, the lottery money has been available since 1988, and at the top of this page that you will see is Section 14, and I've highlighted the words in the Constitution that folks have used to allocate the most, and it's protection the state's water and fish. And traditionally, that has included hiring scientists to figure out how best to protect water and fish. Dr. Sorensen has actually been funded three times by the lottery money, starting in 2003. And I think we would agree that this money well spent. But I bring up that mainly to show you the words of the Constitution. Section 15 tells us how we can spend legacy money. Specifically, the outdoor heritage money can be used to protect wetlands and habitat for fish, and the clean water money can be used to protect water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams. And there's that word protect again that allows us to allocate money to investigate the things that are harming or could harm habitat for fish and the water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams. One of the things I will note that's in my bill is the practice that the LCCMR uses, and that is not funding administrative costs at the U. It only funds the things that are directly involved in the protection of the state's water and fish. So one of the practical issues that we're going to have to work out is having the university take over the administrative costs. But they've been doing that for Dr. Sorensen because LCCMR has not funded that. And I think that's the same kind of rule that we would have to use for the legacy money.
Representative Wagenius, is it okay? I just want to make sure, does anybody have any questions for Dr. Sorensen? He's going to actually get up and walk out here in the next couple of seconds. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Sorensen, for being with us this morning.
Oh, well, thank you.
Appreciate that very much. Representative Wagenius highlights the language of the Constitution, and as far as the Clean Water Fund goes, the money is to protect water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams. Could you kind of outline how you see your work as protecting water quality?
Dr. Sorensen.
Good question. Actually, it's directly germane. I see water quality through my work with watersheds as basically being defined as the clarity of the water, things living in the water, the things that eat the things in the water. So it's sort of an integrative thing of how nice it is to swim in, drink, look at, enjoy. That's quality to me. And the carps that we study destroy water quality. The common carp eat things off the bottom. They increase the turbidity. They remove the plants, and that causes algae blooms. Conversely, the Asian carp are extremely efficient filter feeders that greatly disrupt food chains and remove all the plankton from the water so that they become clear and devoid of all life, and the game fish disappear. So that's all about, at least from a biologist's perspective, that's quality. That's the basis of quality, is the biology of what lives in the water.
Follow-up, Representative Parkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the issue of water clarity is always one that we kind of wrestle with on both sides.
Right.
Sometimes we look at improved clarity as an improvement in water quality,
right.
And you're saying that in this case the improved clarity is actually a detriment to water quality?
It certainly can be, because what happens with Asian carp and zebra mussels is that they, which I haven't worked directly with, but they remove certain types of organisms from the environment, leaving others. So you're still left with the situation where you have some pretty nasty green algae blooms later in the summer. And So it just really drastically alters things. That's so, yeah, it's mixed. It's confused. It's complicated. But there'll be fundamental changes in how water systems work in Minnesota, how people enjoy them for fishing, swimming, drinking, etc. So it's about quality of life as it is as much about the specific chemical.
Thank you. Just one more question, Dr. Sorensen, and thank you again.
Yeah.
Is there a difference in water quality effects in relation to Asian carp as compared to common carp?
Yes.
And could you identify that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what common carp do, and they kind of contrast with each other. So what common carp do is they bottom feeders. So they feed in the bottom. And they, so this is why I'm funded by a lot of local watersheds, because their water quality is perceived as being horrible, and it is. And these things feed in the bottom, they can dig up to a foot or two in the bottom, and that causes great enhancement of turbidity, and as they do that, they rip out all the plants, and the plants are the foundation of the food web, so that there's general collapse and great disruption of all the plankton communities that feed the fish and the birds, and the whole thing. So they make water much, much more turbid and odorous and just outright unenjoyable for both the organisms that live there and the people that use the water. And the habitat's wrecked.
Representative Hansen. I'm sorry, Representative Tarkles.
Well, follow-up. I was looking for the contrast between
the Asian carp, it's sort of just the opposite. Life isn't easy. So they basically are extremely fine filter feeders, and they go through the water, and they basically sort of the things that the common carp are promoting, they start to remove. And they remove all these fine, so the basis of the food chain, the habitat, are the things that grow in there, these plankton, and they remove all that. So they cause great increased clarity of water at certain times, but this causes a whole change in food chain, and it will clarify the water in early spring and summer, but then usually there's a collapse at the end of the year because they leave certain types of undesirable, noxious, I know it's complicated, blue-green algae in the water, which are odorous and poisonous. So it's really a, we've had stable ecosystems, high-quality habitats in Minnesota since the last glaciation for about 10,000 years. It's all changing with these things. And it's a mixed bag. Some ways that are maybe a little bit better, but most ways, on average, it's a lot worse.
Thank you.
Representative Ham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sorensen, yesterday we had a presentation from DNR about minnows and the Dakotas, and had some photos of Asian carp minnows and showing about the importation potentially
in the bait
industry. When I was growing up, I remember common carp moving through open drainage ditches.
Yes.
Can both common carp or Asian carp minnows move through drainage systems?
Yes. I certainly know common carp can, and easily. And although actually there's an easy fix for that, and that's where I'm going in a few moments. Bubble systems can hold them back. I believe there's increasing evidence that silver carp also move through drainage systems into lakes that adjoin large river systems, and that's actually the guy I was visiting in St. Louis yesterday. That's one of the things he studies. That's
follow
a legitimate
up.
Concern.
Thank you, Dr. Sorensen. Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Sorensen, and just to clarify, that would include open ditches and culvert or pipe?
Dr. Sorensen.
Certainly open ditches for both species. Certainly culverts for common carp. I do not know for silver carp about closed culvert.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Carrying along on the similarities or differences between common carp and the Asian carp, in terms of control, are they related more than just by a single name, or are there, in the research on common carp, are there any things we can carry forward in the attempts to control these different kinds of carp?
Dr. Sorensen. Yes. I think there's quite a bit to be learned and used. Both species are somewhat closely related, not incredibly closely, but both. So when we develop control mechanisms, one of the things we like to look for are what we call integrated controls, multiple tool sets that target weaknesses in their ecology. And these species share some key points in their ecology. They both spawn every year and have several million eggs and live for multiple years. But they spawn in areas, they spawn with tiny eggs in areas where the eggs are susceptible. And at least in common carp, we found this is their Achilles heel. The eggs are incredibly vulnerable. They're just tasty little morsels, frankly. And if there's healthy habitat for other fishes, we find that they'll eat every single one. It's amazing. They'll eat every single one. It's just like candy to them. So I think the same situation is true with Asian carp. All the eggs are being released in the middle of the river. There's still, that's a real weakness that, frankly, the federal government isn't looking at yet, just because they can't do everything. But that would be one weakness we would immediately start to explore with Asian carp. So that's another huge weakness is that they have to migrate to these areas to spawn. And combined with that, they both have incredibly good sense of hearing, about 50 to 100 times better than our native fish, actually. They're really sensitive to sound. And that means that it's possible, and this is what we're developing for common carp with LCCMR funding, to develop small-scale bubbling systems that produce sounds that deter them. And I'm almost certain that's why the silver carp jump, that bubbler systems could be very effective against them if targeted in a reasonable manner. So that's two tools that should be really good. They both also are very well-developed sense of smell, and they use pheromones. This is something I study. Chemical cues communicate to each other. They look the same to you, a male and female carp. They look the same to each other. They tell each other by smell, and they use common sets of chemicals. This is what I'm being funded to do with Asian carp. And I believe that pheromonal controls and baits and attractants would be useful, or, you know, different flavors of the same approach to build an integrated toolbox. And so there's a lot of that in essence, I think, are three pretty major ways. So I see, yes, there's some distinct differences, but they're more common. There's more in common with each other than there are differences. And certainly, they're both invasive for very similar reasons that could be targeted.
Representative Fabian, were you done, Representative Anderson? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on the water quality. More of a comment than a question, but to Representative Torkelson's question there on water quality, you know, we designate uses in Minnesota for our waters, and I think it's important that we do that. I'm glad we do. But we can have uses that, you know, maybe some folks in some areas of the state will want carp. They have a designated use. We got a carp pond, that's what we're going to have. Most of us, at least in my part of the state, we don't want carp. And, you know, having people out there skiing and these fish jumping out of the lake, that's not what we want. So it's very much tied to the quality of our designated uses. So I just wanted to put that out there because it's really important. There's no way we can have our recreational economy and have these fish jumping out of the lake up in my neck of the woods anyway.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Representative Deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Doctor. You may have answered this before I was here. I'm thinking that if the agents get up into the upper watershed, that the ducks are really going to have holy heck raised with them because we already have a problem. And with the lack of wetlands that we need, the wetlands that we still have. I mean, I'm thinking of Net Lake near Orr, Minnesota. On a native reservation, if you had Asian carp in there and you have common carp in there, I mean, the 100,000+ ringbills that go through there every year aren't going to have anything to eat when they arrive. Sounds to me like. Is that?
Yeah, between
Dr. Sorensen.
Yes, I'm sorry. The way I look at it, between the common carp destroying the bottom and the Asian carp destroying the top half of the water column, there isn't going to be much left. It's not going to be good. I can't see any pluses in it at all. These animals, Asian carp the same way. Common carp now are 50 to 70% of the biomass of many of the lakes around here. you don't know it because they're crafty. They sneak around in the dark, turbid waters that they've destroyed. But that's what it is. They control the ecosystem. And the same thing's true with Asian carp down the Illinois River. So everything kind of, they're what we call environmental engineers. They re-engineer it. So the things that used to do well, the ducks and many of the game fish, not all, but many of the game fish we're familiar with, the plants, it will all change. And I don't think it's going to change for the better.
Follow-up, Representative Deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is a little bit different, but you talked about earlier. You talked about predators that are eating the eggs.
Yes.
And common carp. So would that be like crappies or bluegills or northern pike? Or what is what
bluegills in particular.
Dr. Sorensen, thank you. Yeah. Additional follow-up, Representative Deal?
Nope.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Mr. Sorensen, or Dr. Sorensen.
Yeah.
One other question. This may be outside of your realm of expertise, but could you describe a little bit about the role of carp activities in releasing phosphorus into our waters?
Dr. Sorensen.
That's a really interesting question. It's not totally out of our... getting back to your water quality issue, when I started this work about 10 years ago, I defined water quality as just chemicals in the water and that kind of biochemical measure. But I soon realized that what people really care about when they talk about quality is how they perceive it, how they use it. And phosphorus is a big issue in that area. So we're funded by watersheds, and we measure phosphorus routinely. So the relationship we've discovered with carp and phosphorus is an indirect but important one. And that is that although they stir up the bottom, that isn't releasing too much phosphorus. But what's the real problem is that common carp are environmental engineers, and they totally destabilize the system by destroying the basic ecosystem itself and the plants and the plankton that live in there. So when we have large numbers of carp and phosphorus, the problem is what they're doing to the plants and the phytoplankton, which are recycling nutrients in the system, not that they're directly having that effect. Does that
follow up, Representative Torkel?
Some sense to you?
Yeah, thank you. And would the Asian carp have a role in the amount of phosphorus in our waters?
Dr.
Sorensen. Well, they will in the same sense, in that they're really I mean, this is, it's never simple. I'm sure they will, because they will massively re-engineer and design the food webs in those systems. And that's, the food webs are what determine how much, often how much free nutrients are available. You know, we've discovered that if you don't deal, by the way, with these invasive fish, that role is so dominant, you're not going to really fix the phosphorus issues. That's been true in many lakes that we've looked at, that the phosphorus is largely what we call internal, coming from inside the lake, so it's how it's being cycled by all the... there's some coming from the outside, but you guys have spent a lot of money and time fixing the outside sources in many cases, not all cases, at least the urban areas. So there's a lot of residual phosphorus that's totally recycling all the time. The lakes are alive. It is what it is. It's clear or it's turbid because of things living in there, and these carp are going to just really... They are and will dramatically alter that.
Thank you. Representative Hack, or Representative Tarkelson? Representative
Hackbart. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sorensen, this issue's been around a long time, these Asian carp, but we've talked about this for, I don't know, 5, 6, 8 years now.
Sure.
And we've probably been dragging our feet and not doing what we should have been doing a long time ago. All kinds of studies, research, what are we going to do, which way should we go, how much money are we going to spend, where it's coming from. So we're kind of behind 8-ball right now, and what are we going to do, and we've got to do something now. But I think other places and other states and other universities have been doing studies, and there's been research done, and there are research centers out there, and I believe there's professors that are working on this in other states. Listening to this debate for a number of years now, it seems to me that there are places that are doing this already. What is different about about Representative Wagenius's bill and what you might be doing with that money as opposed to what's been done already? What is the research that's been done so far? Is it going to be duplicative? What's different?
Sure.
I know that there's is it in Indiana? Is it Notre Dame?
Notre Dame.
Where is it being done now? That a lot of extensive work and research has been done already. How are you going to enhance that or move on from that? I mean, are you going from what they're using and moving beyond that? Or where? What's different,
Dr.
No, that's a great question. So actually, you touched upon the only other center that I know of, University of Notre Dame, which is a private university in Indiana. And there, though they do work a little bit with smallmouth bass issues, which are a local issue, and crayfish, which are an issue in Indiana, they're not substantive issues here. Frankly, neither are Asian carp in Indiana. What Indiana has specialized in, David Lodge's lab, is eDNA work. And they've developed that tool and that approach, measurement of DNA in the water, as a way of monitoring presence of invasive species. But they're really not dealing with, for instance, Asian carp directly. They're a private Catholic university and academic circles. I mean, what's really different about the center I'm approaching is it would be locally focused on local issues here. Asian carp that we're facing, the common carp, the zebra mussel. University of Notre Dame, as far as I know, doesn't have any work going on zebra mussel control. It wouldn't be in their mission statement. They're not a public university. So that would be one really major difference. As far as duplication goes, I think one advantage of putting this to an academic institution is that we are under pressure to publish all the time, and you can't publish something twice. So, I mean, just from a practical side, I have no reason for the life of me to try and just do something that somebody else has done again. That's not interesting to me. I receive absolutely no rewards from it. It doesn't benefit you either. So there's plenty of really interesting and important work to be done. And, you know, that's what I'd look to do. And I think if you speak with the DNR, I mean, that's what I would hope this group, if this center gets formed, it would actively be working with the DNR. I would hope, frankly, that it would even be a DNR position embedded within it, and that we would be at the forefront in this country and trying to protect Minnesota before it's too late. It's not too late here. We're a little bit late, but it's not too late. It's too late in Illinois. It's not too late here. They're Asian carp, all right. At least there's DNA. But there isn't a breeding population. It's not too late. So it's just time to do something. And if we don't do it, I don't see. The federal government is focused on stopping them from getting through to Lake Michigan, not in protecting Minnesota, not in actually even controlling or reducing Asian carp in Mississippi waters. That's not their goal. It's to protect Great Lakes.
Thank you, Dr. Sorensen. Follow-up, Representative Hecker.
One last thing. So, Dr. Sorensen, so you would look at what Notre Dame's done as far as eDNA.
Oh, of course.
And use that and not duplicate that and move beyond that.
Dr. Sorensen.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Sorensen, you've talked about kind of some of the things that we can learn about these species. I'm kind of wondering, well, you know, in areas where these carp have already infiltrated, so what? But in areas that they haven't, it seems that we've got kind of two different issues. One is how do we keep them out of waters that they haven't gotten into? Once they're infested, I mean, is it what is our goal at that point? Is it reasonable to believe we're going to remove them from those particular waters, or I'd be interested in your comments around
that. Dr. Sorensen, and then could you also just quickly talk about how you've put the tracking devices and that's helped you in cases where there's high population?
Sure.
Dr. Sorensen.
So you're right that there's multiple things going on here. There's trying to prevent something from coming in. I mean, I often look at medical technology, you know, so you want to inoculate people or survey populations to make sure diseases aren't coming to the U.S. when you cross the border. It's the same thing, but if it's here, do you just give up on it? Is it hopeless? No. I mean, you just adopt a different approach, and you adopt one that's targeted to control, and you start working on it. And I was just asked to comment. So, for instance, on common carp, one of the things we found was that We're using what's called the Judas fish approach, which was initially developed in Australia, actually. And we found that we put radio tags in these fish, and we followed them across large-scale landscapes. And we found what appeared to be random is actually quite organized, and that they form very distinct aggregations in the middle of the winter. I still don't know why exactly, but for instance, Lake Riley, one of the areas we worked in, there was 4,500 carp there. The average carp was 20 years old. The people in that lake had been suffering with poor water quality, couldn't even sleep at night because there were so many carp feeding and eating, but they were all 20 years old. So what we found was that they all aggregated every winter in one area about the size of a football field. And once we found that, we hired a commercial fisherman one afternoon. They were out of there. So sometimes, you know, you find these things. So I guess I'm saying you have to start following a couple tracks, prevention, detection and prevention, and also control and mitigation. And I don't want to give up on an environment, and I don't think it's necessary. There are solutions. Sometimes they're a little harder to come by. Does it kind of answer your question? So, you know, so as we try to stop Asian carp, that was my one last point, or zebra mussel from spreading any further, we should be simultaneously realizing that's a temporary deterrent and looking for things to deal with it once they breach those walls. And the sooner we start looking, the better. There are things that might just take a little while to find, but we can find them.
Dr. Sorensen, I appreciate your willingness to stick around. Members, just to let you know, there are a few things on our agenda that we are not going to do. We are going to skip, we've let DNR know, we're going to skip the walkthrough of the DNR's AIS bill, including the presentation they have, the long-term funding AIS report. Both of those are, I believe, available online or will be, and they're in the packet and for the audience. So I would encourage folks to look at those going forward. Representative Wagenius, I think we're going to end up having to hold off on your House File 1644, which is the AIS surcharge fee on boats, and we will move into Representative Hackbart's House File 1809 after we get done with Dr. Sorensen. I'm not cutting off the discussion with Dr. Sorensen now, but I want to let people know we need to have the discussion of this issue of Dr. Sorensen, Representative Wagenius's House File 1963, and then Representative Hackbart's bill, because they will be some of the very first things we'll be dealing with when this committee meets again. Next, I have Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Sorensen, for being here. I'd like to do a little segue from Representative Hackbarth's question and also what Representative Wagenius said. She talked about bringing the best and the brightest here to Minnesota to tackle this problem. I guess one of the things that I'm also concerned about is do we have people right here in Minnesota that can fill those positions, obviously? And then how do you bring people up to speed with regards to, you know, where do you start in this whole thing? I mean, to me, it's like, how do you build a house? You start with the foundation. What's your foundation? Now, other than the equipment that you need, then where does the study actually start, and how do you perceive that moving forward?
Dr. Sorensen.
Okay. Great question. So we do have a solid base here. I think Minnesota has a solid national and international reputation for work on invasive species. But we could use more help. But we already have, beside myself, we have Dr. Ray Newman. We have a research associate working with me, Dr. Beyer, who's been working here 6-7 years now. We've been publishing. We're known. So we have a foundation. We have some people working in DNA. So there's some people working in invasive insects and things like that and plants. So Minnesota's there's a place to start. How do you then sort of pick up speed, I guess, is the question. I think in my experience, a really productive way was actually to start working with local watersheds and DNRs. So when I started in 2003, we started going out to different watersheds and working and seeing exactly what the problems were. And then, frankly, we've been funded by a lot of them now. It's been very helpful. So we get out there and work with them, and I found lots and lots of volunteers. Everyone seems really anxious. It's just been amazing to me, frankly. When we go out in the lakes, people come out and bring us coffee, and people are just so happy to see something happening that it just kind of builds. Does it So we'd bring, create a couple new positions at the university, give them some facilities. I've got lots of connections, particularly with local watershed districts. I know where zebra mussel problems are. I know where problems are with various plants. I have great connections, I think, with the DNR. We know where the carp are. I have connections now with the Mississippi River Panel for the National Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force. I know all the Asian carp people. I pretty much know how to plug in. I guess I'm getting older, and I don't think I've gotten too many people mad at me. So I think we have a pretty good way to move forward, you know, in some kind of systematic fashion.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then finally, your attention to this problem are you going to have, are you having multiple studies going on, or is it your anticipation that this is going to be the focus of your laser beam as we move forward after this program becomes funded?
Dr. Sorensen.
I'm not quite sure I understood your question, but
clarification, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I'm just wondering, are you going to be continuing with other studies, or is this going to be your sole job, I'll say?
Dr. Sorensen.
Oh, that's a great question.
Dr. Sorensen, he's asking if you want to take on the opportunity to
the
solution to this problem.
Well, it's a little daunting. I have to talk with the university about that. I would be willing to do it if they give me a little bit of break in teaching and so forth, because it's a pretty serious commitment. But, yes, I'm interested in it for sure, if the opportunity's right.
Dr. Sorensen, I've got Representative Knuth next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Sorensen, and appreciate you being here and talking about the opportunities the university can bring in terms of bringing in world-class researchers and applying them to problems in Minnesota. And I kind of have a two-pronged question. One is just reiterating what other species or types of ecosystems you'd be working on. We've been talking a lot about carp, and I think carp are clearly important, but they're by no means the only species, and you know, we've got the zebra mussel or the spiny water flea, or in Lake Michigan they have the round goby. You know, you can go down the list of various things, and I'm curious how you see this center, the scientists working together on sort of broader species and interactions and that sort of thing, and then also how you see it. You know, the university has both a broader research mission, but also the land grant mission, and how you see those two balancing with sort of the broader research agenda and then the land grant mission of being on the ground here in Minnesota.
Well, I'll answer
Dr. Sorensen.
The last question first. I think it's absolutely it would be folly if this center didn't have a full-time extension person. This would broaden the university's land grant mission and be part of it. So that is how we'd work with getting that information out there, because it's applied research. If it's not applied, it's just kind of stupid, frankly. So at least that's my perspective. That's my point in my life. So that's I'd want a full-time person to do nothing and work with the DNR, maybe more even, you know. So that would be that. The other question is, how does this disparate group, seemingly disparate group, work together? Well, there are a couple, at least in my plan, there were a couple positions that would tie everybody together. And one was a key to controlling and understanding invasive species is just knowing how many there are. That's really hard right now. I mean, it's like sampling Asian carp in the river is like running around your lawn blindfolded with a net trying to catch a squirrel or something. They could be all in the trees, but you'll never get them because they're smart and they see you coming and they swim away. And that's kind of the situation. So we have to develop tools, but these tools could be used if we'd be focusing on molecular and supplementing and amplifying the work that started at Notre Dame, I would hope, would be a these molecular tools be equally applicable to zebra mussel as to Asian carp. It wouldn't just be Asian carp. So that would tie people together. There'd be a statistician to help guide the decisions to make sure that they were done in appropriate and efficient manners, and that would tie people together. Then, of course, we'd be sharing ecosystems together. So zebra mussel, like carp, and right now, the situation with Asian carp is quite different because they're here, but they're not we're just trying to deter right now. But the common carp and the zebra mussel and the invasive plants, they're all found in the same ecosystem at the same time. And that's what my lab has found over the last, you can't deal with one if you don't deal with the others. It's all part of the same system. So I think we'd all be working together on this. That particularly if we're working through local watersheds and DNR study lakes and things like that, like I mentioned before. That's why we got into phosphorus. We found we couldn't control carp without addressing phosphorus, so we sort of just kind of happened. But it's a natural thing.
Thank you, Dr. Sorensen. Thank you for coming in. I'm just going to have one last, just a real small question. Do you think if we properly fund, and I don't know how you define properly fund, the research component, should we also think about putting barriers in the lock and dam to it's something that no other state's been willing to do? Do you think that would be a good idea for the state of Minnesota? Dr. Sorensen.
Yeah, well, I guess...
was your answer yes? Because we could just end right now. No, Dr. Sorensen. Thank you.
Yeah, in addition, so I think there's a real risk that these things are, you know, they're coming upstream. I think a strategically placed barrier or two as a temporary deterrent delay system while we buy time with the research would be a judicious move. And the way I look at it is you don't want to be kicking yourself 20 years from now because you just didn't do something that's simple. And I'm not saying put them all over the place in ways that are incredibly expensive and unlikely, but a couple well-placed barriers to buy us a little time seems to me be that's what I would do.
Thank you, Dr. Sorensen. Thank you for coming in. We appreciate it. Was there any final comments, Representative Wagenius? Then I was going to move into the next item. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, a couple of things I want to talk to you about. First of all, Dr. Sorensen does have a formal presentation that he gave to LOHC. It's on my computer, and I'm going to make sure that I send it around as soon as I get back to my office. That's one thing. A second thing, embedded in his figures is a lot of stuff that ought to be bonded for, and that hasn't been sorted out. And I will commit to you that I'll work with him and some folks at the U to figure out what of this is bondable and what has to be spent in cash. And I suspect a lot of that, a lot more than you think, is bondable. That's just my reading of that. Can't guarantee anything. The final thing I would like to say is I am a huge advocate of funding this, and that's obvious, and funding his vision. My thought is that this is not a normal year. I mean, this is not a budget year, but we do have money within water, and we have it in heritage, that we could appropriate enough money for Dr. Sorensen, enough money for at least two or three folks that would be new, because he said we need some new people in this proposal, some new people, and some people at the U who will be working on this, who are already working on it. And then next year, we can do it all over again, so some money can come, so the U could figure out what to apply for LCCMR, for waters, and for heritage. So within these 2 years, I think we can get the job done. And we can fund it out for the 6 or 8 years. It would not be a recurring thing that we would have to come back and fund year after year, because I don't think it works. I don't think Dr. Sorensen thinks it works. But we could do the 6 years and fund it as one individual one-time appropriation.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Thank you, Dr. Sorensen. We look forward to continuing to work with you. Next, members, we're going to hear from Representative Hackbart, and I believe you have a testifier, Representative Hackbart. It's House File 1809. Members, just to reiterate what Representative Wagenius was talking about, currently, Lessard-Sams, as a recommendation, they modified it at their last meeting to allocate $5.5 million to the aquatic invasive species issue. It's fairly broad at this point, their recommendation. There is additional money available in clean water legacy money that we did not. It's gotten to be a little bit more money available on the bottom line there than was thought last year. But from Representative Torkelson's line of questioning about clean water money, AIS would be a new direction that money historically has not gone for things like that. That's not to say that there aren't many of us that support that idea of looking at that, but that's a discussion that we'll need to have going forward. Then Representative Wagenius also talked about LCCMR. LCCMR last year, members in special session, we approved their two-year budget, and so only would it be if there's some cancel backs or some reprioritizing or funding from different sources or literally the cancellation of projects that would be unfortunate to go down that road of canceling something that's in the middle of the works. So those are the different funding sources we've talked about, and so that's what will be before us on that. To this point, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering before our next meeting if maybe Mr. Reinholz could bring the committee the history of how much money has been spent specifically in the Clean Water Fund on research. I know that we've funded in a couple bienniums research that's being conducted at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So if we could see the precedent and how much has been funded there, I think that'd be helpful for the committee to look at that precedent.
And that's a great idea, Representative Hansen. Why don't we ask Mr. Reinholz to expand on that and confirm with Mr. Becker at Lessard Sams and Clean Water how much is actually on the bottom line, understanding they both have goals to keep a certain amount, a flexible amount, but at least some working capital for, so that their checkbook doesn't bounce, so to speak. And then to confirm with Ms. Thornton on what is actually available, the limited possibilities in LCCMR. Welcome. Any other thoughts on that at this point? Thank you. And thanks for the good questions with Dr. Sorensen. Welcome, Representative Hackbart. Please present the informational hearing on House File 1809.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, House File 1809 is a fish barrier bill. It would install electric fish barriers at three different lock and dams along the Mississippi River. It'd be Lock and Dam 2, 1, and at the Upper St. Anthony Falls. And the chairman and I were at the last governor's roundtable or task force meeting or whatever it was that the DNR made a presentation, and the governor was there, and we heard from the Army Corps of Engineers. And I took from that this is a very, very urgent and almost an emergency status that we have to get something in place right away to stop these Asian carp should they be coming north. And so I wrote this bill, and it's just to get our foot in the door. It's very, very basic. But you will see in the presentation I have with me today, Mr. Jeff Griffin, that is going to make a presentation. I'm not going to take up a lot of your time because his presentation is what we really need to see, and hopefully we'll hear testimony from the public testimony that we have lined up too. But it's for about $13 million to put these electric fish barriers in these three different locations, and Mr. Griffin will show you exactly what we're talking about and how effective they are and the history behind electric fish barriers. This is for the very most modern technology that we have to stop these Asian carp coming north. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like you to introduce Mr. Jeff Griffin.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you're with, and then go ahead with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey G. Griffin. I'm the CEO of G-Cubed Engineering in Chatfield, Minnesota. Got sleeping from Mr. Sorensen's presentation. I have a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from North Dakota State University with an emphasis in water resource engineering. I have a master's degree in civil engineering from the University of Minnesota, St. Anthony Falls Hydraulic Lab. I have an MBA from the University of St. Thomas in town here. For 10 years, I was the hydraulic and hydrologic engineer for the Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Engineering. While at the DNR there, I designed numerous electrical fish barriers, mechanical fish barriers, slope and culverts, hydraulic barriers, water control structures. Pretty much that was my expertise. 12 years ago, I went on my own at G-Cubed Engineering. While at G-Cubed, I worked in numerous consultant jobs for the DNR, for Bowser, Ducks Unlimited, Minnesota Waterfall, Trout Unlimited. In that capacity, designed numerous fish barriers all over the state and all over the Midwest. Some of the slides I give you, you're looking at with the GGG in the upper left. The date isn't wrong here. It's February 27, 2002. In 2002, the DNR hired me to come to their fishery conference and give their fishery staff a presentation on fish barriers and fish barrier design. During that presentation, I talked about the three main barriers in Minnesota. The first is hydraulic barrier. That's the simplest and the cheapest. If you have enough hydraulic drop, like a dam or a slope and culvert, you can just stop the fish and it doesn't cost you any money. There's no electricity, there's no maintenance. Essentially a carp can jump 6 to 7 feet, and so if during a 100-year event you keep the tailwater and the headwater more than 7 feet apart, they can't get through. It's a real simple barrier. On smaller watersheds, you can take a culvert and slope it enough so the velocities are such in the culvert so the fish can't pass. A mechanical fit barrier is essentially screens, where you put screens across a channel. It's more used in a small system. It's a lot of times used to maybe protect a wetland, where you stop the big ones from getting through, but the little ones will get through. However, a lot of the wetlands, they'll winter kill, so the little ones never become big ones. And so, as Peter Sorensen talked about, you don't get the big ones in a wetland burrowing in the mud and ruining the turbidity. The third thing is electrical fish barriers. In situations in Minnesota where it's flat, where you don't have the vertical drop, the best way typically has always been to put electrical fish barrier in, and that 100% stops the fish from getting through. I got involved with this particular project only a couple months ago. I read in my local paper a letter to the editor from numerous fisheries groups talking about their concerns with the DNR's proposal for bubble and sound barriers. Back when I gave my presentation 10 years ago, bubble and sound barriers didn't even exist. So I did some research. I called the DNR, asked for some sources for their data, because they talked about pretty high percentages of stopping these fish from going through with a bubbler and sound system. When you actually look at the data, all of this testing was done either in a hatchery raceway or in a channel that's only 3 feet deep. Well, there's a big difference between putting an air system at the bottom of a 3 foot deep hatchery raceway or a 3 foot deep body of water and dealing with the Minnesota or Mississippi River, where we have 30 feet plus of water during flood times. There's no data regarding what would happen if you're trying to put a bubbler down 30 feet below its impact in that sort of column of water. The other thing that struck me real seriously was the fact that none of the research was done in the spring of the year when the carp are trying to migrate. The carp, during the majority of the year, they're just kind of hanging around. But in the spring, when they're wanting to go upstream and spawn, they're real persistent little rascals, and they'll just go and go and go. And to me, the research has to be done at that time, otherwise your data really is skewed. I know at a recent carp summit, it stated that they feel that these systems in this type of situation on the Minnesota or Mississippi would be more like 60% effective. To me, if you're going to let 40% through, you just will put your money into habitat and work on the habitat upstream so that native species can fight off these guys, versus putting in a system that lets 30 or 40% through. This is a picture of electric fish barrier I put in the early 90s. This is actually in Lake Christina, up by between Alexandria and Fergus Falls. This was to protect a very high-end waterfall lake. And in talking with the DNR officials, They feel to this day there's not been one fish that has ever passed through this barrier. Now, Christina does get repopulated with carp, but that's because they can't kill the 100% with rotenone. What they do is they try to rotenone the lake, get rid of the carp so they can start from scratch. But according to the DNR staff, it's just really hard in that particular instance with the little pockets and stuff all over to get 100% kill. And so it does get repopulated with carp, but they are not coming through the barrier. The next installation is in Huron Lake in southwestern Minnesota. I put this in the middle 90s. This is real similar to what I'm going to be proposing with you in the lock and dams. This channel is about 80 foot wide, about 15 feet deep on a 100-year event, and we 100% stop the fish from passing through this installation. Here's another picture of Huron Lake just from a different view. Essentially what you see is you have seven electrodes running across. They go down the sides, go across the bottom of the channel, and we use DC pulsating power. Essentially what happens, the further the fish swim, the more they get. So that starts out with a tingle, they keep going further and further. By the time they get to the upper end, they eventually get stiff, their muscles go numb, current takes them down, they come to, and in the spring of the year when they really want to go, they try again, and it's just an iterative cycle. In the spring of the year at this installation, like I said, it's about 80-foot wide channel, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of feet downstream, it's just black covered with carp when they're wanting to come up and move upstream and spawn. I think this structure was funded by the LCCMR back at the day. Here's the lock and dams that we're talking about. In the upper left is the upper St. Anthony Falls, and then we go down to Lock and Dam 1. Both of those are on the Mississippi. Further down, we have Lock and Dam 2, which is on the Minnesota and Mississippi. I looked briefly at the St. Croix and talking with some DNR staff at Echo Services. They actually feel that the St. Croix, there's characteristics in the St. Croix that do not make that very good habitat for the silver carp, for the Asian carp. And so that really wasn't their highest concern in protecting the St. Croix, because they feel that because the hydraulic conductivity of the water there, that they're never going to be a major place for them to reproduce. Here's just a typical lock barrier. You have to the left the upper lock, and then to the right the lower lock. What we're looking at doing is putting an electrical field below the lower lock. And so it's a real simple system. It's not on all the time. It's only on when the boats come. I'm going to explain that further here. Here's a blow-up of it. Essentially what we're going to do below the lower lock, we're going to have to take the existing concrete walls, we're going to have to remove those and put new concrete. And the reason is we got to use insulative concrete, and we also need to use fiberglass rebar versus metallic rebar. That way all the electrical current stays in the water and doesn't get grounded to the ground. So essentially we remove the concrete, put new concrete in, we embed electrodes in it just like we did at Huron Lake, and run a barrier. Essentially what we do, when a boat comes up and the lockmaster turns it on, it herds all the fish out of the area. Once the fish are herded out of the area, they open the gates and go. Here's a little detail of the lock sequence. Default state on the left, you have high water on the left, low water on the right. Go to number 2, you see a boat approaching. The black arrow is my boat. The boat's approaching. Go to number 3. The lock master activates the barrier, sees the boat coming, he or she activates the barrier, herds the fish out of there. Once the fish are out of there, they open the lower gate, let the boat in. The boat passes through in number 5 there. Once the boat's passed through, he or she, the lock master locks the lower lock, and once the lower lock is locked, they can shut the power back off and resume normal operation there. Safety. I want to talk briefly on safety. A lot of people get thinking about, boy, you're electrifying the water, what's that going to do? These DC pulsating barriers are non-lethal. I personally, at the Huron Lake, was out there doing some fine-tuning, slipped into the water. It's a tingle, but it's not lethal. It's important to know that it's AC, your standard AC, is 3 times more harm to a human body than DC. The DNR folks have been dealing with these DC for years. I mean, the same manufacturer that manufactures the pulsators for these manufacture the DNR's electrofishing boats. And so the DNR staff are out with these metallic boats and doing electrofishing all the time. And numerous times a day they get a tingle, do something wrong, and get their hand in the water, and they get a tingle. They're at about five times more of the power than what we are here, and we've never had a problem. Other people have brought up, you know, how do you deal with barges going through? This same system is what's in the Chicago Canal, and they're running through numerous barges an hour in the, and no harm to the barge, no harm to the operators or workers in the barge. In our case, this is a lot more a controlled and safe system than a normal barrier like at Huron Lake, which is on 24/7. That barrier's on, never shuts off, except real low flow when the fish aren't in the area. But in our case, as I previously stated, the electric field is controlled by the lock master. And so that field only runs when a boat comes and they're going to open the gate and let a boat pass through. Once that boat has passed through and the gates are shut, this is off. Additionally, you always have, with the lock master running it, you have added protection that should there be an incident where you have a boater and they jump out of the boat into the current, thing, shut it off. You got a person there 24/7 running the lock, and so you always have that as a fuse plug in case of emergency or someone exhibits bad judgment. Lastly, in these lock and bear, and where we're proposing these, the boaters have the option of going around. I mean, there's access points, so they can put their boat in different places if they absolutely do not feel comfortable going through electric area at a lock operation. I want to start with lock and dam number one. If you remember right, I talked about the most effective barrier system in the world is a hydraulic system. On lock and dam number one, the reason I chose this one is the head difference between the upper pool and the lower pool is 35 feet. And so at 35 feet, even on the 1965 flood, the flood of record, it was 15 feet differential, and so they can't jump through. And so the majority of this entire system shown on your screen is 100% protected 100% of the time. It's just the lock chamber is the only place that isn't protected. So if we would take that 50-foot lock chamber, put electrical barrier downstream of it, activate that barrier whenever the gates flow open up, we got 100% barrier at this situation. It's like a textbook thing. I mean, it's easy to put in. It's easy to manage, and like I said, you don't have to worry about the remaining, 500 feet of channel width of the Mississippi, because that is covered with a hydraulic barrier. Construction costs $3.5 million. That covers the entire lock barrier. It also covers putting electrical barrier. There's a couple tubes in the dam that we'd have to electrify also, so the fish don't go through the tubes. The annual operating cost for electricity is $3,500. What I did there is I called the lock master, found out that in 2011 they opened that gate 2,113 times. He said on the average the gates open 20 minutes at a time, and so we took the 2,113 times 20 minutes, and I know how much electricity it costs, and put this together. The other barriers in the state, the DNR has typically purchase an annual maintenance contract where the manufacturer of the equipment would come out once a year and test it, make sure the field's all tests okay, checks all the equipment over, and they felt that's a value. And so I put in, I called the manufacturer and found out what they would charge for a maintenance agreement on this barrier here. St. Anthony Falls is almost a dead ringer to Lock and Dam 1. The lock, once again, 50 foot wide, about 30 foot deep column of water we have to electrify, the rest of the spillway to Lock and Dam 1. The lock, once again, 50 foot wide, about 30 foot deep column of water we have to electrify, the rest of the spillway, there's no problem. Even on a 100 year event, they cannot get around it. This one even has a little more vertical drop, and so it's really almost identical situation. Same cost, $3.5 million, $3,500 a year to run it. Get down to Lock and Dam 2, which Lock and Dam 2 is important because if you get to Lock and Dam 2, you're protecting the Mississippi and the Minnesota. You understand, Upper St. Anthony Falls and Lock and Dam 1, you're only protecting the Mississippi. Lock and Dam 2, the difference between Lock and Dam 2 and the other two is the red section on your picture going across the river. By that, I mean during flood times, and I'm going to define that. In talking with the DNR, they feel it's somewhere between a 7 and 10 year event on average that the tailwater is going to get high enough. There's only 12 feet of hydraulic head difference between the up above this and below it. And so keep in mind, about 6 or 7 feet, a carp can jump. And so during flood events, that tailwater comes up and gets so they can scoot through it. And like I said, in talking with the DNR, it appears like that's somewhere between a 7-10 year event. So essentially, by putting a lock barrier in only here, we have it protected, you know, 90% of the time. But if we get a major flood, if we get a flood event, tailwater is going to come up, and they're going to be able to go around and go over the major spillway here. And so, at lock and dam number two, there's just a photo of it that may help. In the lower right, you see the numerous tainer gates, and that's the section that during flood events they'd be able to go through. In the upper left, you see the lock. And in this case, it's a larger lock. It's 110 foot wide versus 50 at the other ones, but a real similar installation. Construction cost for the lock barrier itself is $6 million. The reason it went from 3.5 to 6 is we went from a 50 foot wide to 110 foot wide lock chamber. Annual operating cost is $6,100. Once again, this is based on real data. They had more transportation through 2893, and then of course it's also a larger area to electrify. I also gave a second proposal here to put what I call a high flow barrier, and that is one to go across the rest of that spillway. So during flood time, so the lock master would have two things going. During normal times, you would turn the barrier on just like you do at the other two, only when a boat's going to pass. The other situation that would kick in here would be we get 5 inches of rain, tailwater comes up, they kick on the rest of it to protect the entire rest of the spillway so no fish can pass through during that time. Keep in mind that's real expensive, but it's only run you know once every 7 to 10 years, according to DNR data. It costs $36,000 a month to run, to electrify that entire section. But like I said, it's not run very often. With that, I'm here to entertain any questions.
Questions, members? Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Griffin. So you're saying that this is a 100% stop when installed?
100% stop.
Mr. Griffin.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, maybe nothing's 100% because you always have people that fishermen that decide to take one and haul it up, or you have bait buckets and stuff. But as far as the barrier, they're not going to get through my barrier. It's done. I put this in. It's done.
Follow up, Representative Deal. Additional questions, Representative. I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for something for Mr. Reinholz to do, check on the bondability of electric barriers if these are able to be paid for through capital investments, and then also on the Coon Rapids Dam, how specific that appropriation is for bonding, if it's specific for the Coon Rapids Dam or if that money could be repurposed for barriers such as this.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Deal.
Well, I don't have a question. I'm really addressing the committee. It would certainly seem that this qualifies for bonding. Capital asset of the state, but I've heard in here several times today that we are behind the power curve in a big way. I mean, if there's any opportunity to get this done earlier than later, it won't be with bonding dollars. Bonding dollars make the most sense to me, but this needs to be accelerated. I mean, I feel like it needs to be done like almost under an emergency order. You know, around my companies, something happens like this, and we say, we're doing it right now. I know state government doesn't work like that, but that's what I feel like is we are under right now. Like, there should be some emergency power that says this has to be done to protect the resources of the state. So I'm all for bonding, but bonding isn't going to happen until, what, August 1st? The money, you know, we sell the bonds, and then we have to have engineering, and you have to have construction season, and you've got 2,800 boats going through this particular facility, and it just causes a whole lot of things. I mean, that's my concern with bonding, although I think it's a great bonding project.
Good point, Representative Dill. Additional comments, Representative Hackbart? Otherwise, I was going to ask the DNR to come down.
Okay, I do have just a couple other
Representative
comments.
Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as the bonding is concerned, I do agree that it is bondable. And if we look at the Hastings site, to put that $20 million barrier across the entire dam, that probably makes sense. We can do that for long term. We can propose that in bonding. But this is an emergency. And this 3/8 of 1% money that the voters passed, I think this is what they expect us to do with that kind of money, especially in a situation like this. When the folks know exactly the urgency of this and to protect the resource that we have in the state of Minnesota, we need to do this now. And we have funds available through Lassard Sands. This only makes sense. It's $13 million to do the three sites, $20 million to do the dam at Hastings, bond for that. But $13 million, there's matching money that we can get from federal money from the DOT. That's $4 million. So you reduce that. We're looking at $9 million from Lassard Sands. That's what we need to get this project done, and we can get it done. We can be smart, and I think the people will be very, very happy with us doing that. At the DNR roundtable, we heard over and over again about redundancy, and it makes sense to put these at those three spots to protect these in all these three different areas. I think there's a lot of people that are concerned about the Minnesota River. Put that at Hastings. Some people don't want to put it at Hastings, but I think it makes absolute sense to protect both the Mississippi and the Minnesota River at Hastings. We need to move forward with that $6 million project there. One more thing, there's folks that are here that were on LCCMR and took a tour of some wind farms a number of years ago, and we stopped by Heron Lake and we've seen that facility. I don't know if you were with Representative Wagenius on that trip or not, but we did actually stop and check this fish barrier out at that time. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm done, and you can bring the DNR up. I don't know if Mr. Griffin has any final comments or not.
Representative Hackbart, just to your point, where it looks like we potentially are looking for somewhere in the neighborhood of $9 million of state money because of the potential federal match, which we're not 100% yet guaranteed that it would be there. The MnDOT is trying to run by the feds. They're very interested. That money is only available, the federal money through MnDOT is only available when we protect the top two locks, the St. Anthony and money spent at Lock and Dam number one, because they feel that would qualify to by putting in electric barriers or some kind of barrier at both lock and dams. It would really ensure that the locks would be able to stay open, and it would keep a whole lot of truck traffic off the road, where if we have to close St. Anthony to protect the upper Mississippi, there's significant commerce moves through that lock and dam, and the traffic on the roads and such would be unbelievable. So that's where they're coming from in the protection. They can't justify the federal money being spent because Hastings does potentially, lock and dam too, overflow at a given time. Now, we didn't have the discussion in regards to Hastings. If we went the full blowing, I don't know about that. But there, the federal match is a significant match. They only need $1 million of non-federal money to match potentially the $4 million available. And then Representative Hackbart, you talked about Lassard Sams being the full source of the $9 million. I just wanted to clarify, are you open to the idea that other legacy money like clean water, which potentially is there, could fund part of your proposal?
Mr. Chairman, yes, absolutely. I'm open to that wherever we can get the money, but I think it is an emergency situation. If we can take some from Lassard Sams, if it's available through clean water, that would be great too. However we can make that work, we have to do it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick questions for Mr. Griffin. One, you described the installation as replacing the cement walls along the sides. Are these cement walls subject to vulnerable to physical damage?
Representative, I'm sorry, Mr. Gibbon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson,
No. I mean, this, to my, the best of my knowledge, this, the smallest lock is 50 foot wide. You have a lock master right there. It isn't a situation where you have bolts ramming into the sides. And so once we put the, you know, remove the wall, put a new Insulcrete in and the fiberglass reinforcing and the electrodes in, are we going to have problems with it getting smashed up and being ineffective? No, in my opinion, that's not the case.
Well, follow up, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. We do know that people do run into things. I'm not, it happens. But another quick question. If we would put this on a fast track, what kind of timeline do you believe would be involved in getting this up and running?
Mr. Griffin.
Once again, Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, the construction portion is about 2 to 3 months process. More importantly is the permitting. You know, once I need to work with the Corps of Engineers, most likely I would recommend that I'll bring in some folks from the Chicago Corps, which we worked with on the Chicago Canal electric barrier, bring them in to educate the St. Paul District of the Corps on electric barriers and their benefits. Might even have to bring in John Coase from President Obama's administration, who is the CARP czar. But you know, we have permitting issues with the Corps of Engineers. We're going to have to get their blessing and incorporate this in their operating plan, and then we have to get through the construction cycle. To be honest with you, there's probably, if we put it off too far, the funding, and you don't get going on the engineering, there's a chance you'll miss putting it in next winter.
Representative Torkelson, follow-up.
Thank you. Just one more issue. To your knowledge, Mr. Griffin, how close are these fish to pounding on the door, shall we say?
Mr. Griffin.
I'm not the expert in that. All I know there is what I've read in Outdoor News and other publications. I'm an engineer, not a biologist.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Griffin, can all these be done? I know the permitting and that stuff can be done in parallel, but is there a capacity to do all three projects construction in parallel with the expertise and materials? And if not, can we do two of them?
Mr. Griffin.
To answer your question, in this economic climate, there will be no problem building all three at once. There's a lot of contractors looking for work. This is general concrete work. Nothing. With proper supervision, we can get this implemented.
Thank you. Follow. Okay, Representative Scott.
My question is already asked.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Yes. Thanks. A couple of questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually like the Lock and Dam 2, and the Lock and Dam 1 makes sense to me. But if the Lock and Dam 1 is 100% effective, why are you then doing St. Anthony 2?
Mr. Always, Griffin.
I'm sorry.
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius. Even though when we put these in, they're obviously powered. We have a backup electric generator, so should the power go out, we still have full control. There's always good to have a factor of safety. If, you know, hypothetically, if the Corps wants to do some work on the lock and dam in the future, I mean, there's just always something that it's good business practice to have a backup. To me, with all the resources that we're protecting upstream, $3.5 million to have a backup is cheap insurance policy.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Well, I still, if you're saying it's 100% on one hand and then saying we're going to spend $3.5 million because it's not 100%, I mean, I have questions about that.
Okay.
But I do like that going down to the lower lock a lot, the number two. I think we all should be talking about that. But my second question is, Mr. Chair, can we have the Corps of Engineers here and talk to them and ask the question, how long will it take to permit this? Because we have no control. We can say that we would like this done fast. But the state doesn't have a control here. It's the federal government. So could we ask to the next hearing, ask the Corps of Engineers to come and tell us what they would do if we gave them the money and had it right there?
Thank you for that question, Representative Wagenius. DNR is staying in the room for the next 14 minutes, and they're leaving from here to go meet with the general from the U.S. Corps of Engineers. So we're hopeful at our next meeting we'll know what the general thinks of this proposal, and they're delivering a message that I'm beginning to hear from this group that we're taking this serious. We're looking at how can we find $13 million to move this forward. So I think they're going to deliver the message to the Corps that we want to look at the possibility of moving forward here and what roadblocks are the feds going to put in the way of making this happen as soon as possible. So I'm hopeful that our next committee hearing will be back before us. We will have an opportunity. We will invite the Corps to specifically be here, and hopefully they will show up and explain their position of how cooperative they can be. Thank you, Representative Bouguinas. Representative Hansen.
My question was asked.
Oh, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mine kind of was also, but I would just follow up on some of the construction things. If these three projects were categorized or prioritized, would you agree that the lock and dam number two would be of the highest priority because it protects two rivers?
Okay. Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, depends on if you're a gambling person. Yeah, Murphy's Law would be we put the money in to build lock and dam two immediately, and we get 6 inches of rain in 7 hours, and it would go around it. But that, you know, I love lock and dam two because you kill two birds with one stone. On the other hand, it's not 100% until you spend the additional $20 million.
Mr. Griffin, just to clarify, and we'll have the DNR when they go to the Corps, I don't believe a rain event has ever caused Lock and Dam 2 to be bypassed. If I'm not mistaken, in my lifetime, it's only been open originally in the spring. Last summer, it may have stayed open longer because of additional rain events, but I don't know if a summer rain event, maybe Mr. Griffin knows, but I don't remember that.
When you say bypassed, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, at Lock and Dam 2, there's never been an event where it's washed around. It's not like Lock and Dam 5 or something further downstream where you have wetlands and stuff where it can wrap around. It's always going to be confined. Even on a 500-year event, it's either going to go through the lock or it's going to go over those gates. However, in the 65 flood, the differential between the headwater and tailwater was only a foot and a half. And so when it's only a foot and a half, the carp could get through if we didn't have the additional barrier put in.
Correct. Thank you. I have Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be for Representative Hackbarth. And I appreciate the presentation about the possibility of different barriers and electric barriers. And I'm just curious, when we appropriate money, it's, you know, millions, upwards, over $10 million. Are there other companies that do this? Would there be an RFP process? How does that all work just to make sure tax dollars are being spent most efficiently?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely, there'd be an RFP process. I don't know how many companies do this. I think there's other companies that do bubble barriers and things like that. I haven't checked that out, but there's probably other companies that do it, and there would be an RFP process, yes.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. Well, Representative Wagenius brought up a good point. Mr. Griffin is saying that this is 100%, but it's 100% when it's operated.
Representative Deal, can you speak into the mic?
It's 100% when it's operated in accordance with the operating specifications. Now, people are human. I mean, there's live wells. There's a lock and dam operator that might open the lock before he remembers to put the electricity on. I mean, things can happen that are beyond the capability of the infrastructure that you put in. And I think that's what he means by the fact that the insurance is the complete barrier at St. Anthony Falls. Regardless of the situation, that will be the stop of all and all. And I think that's what I understood from the presentation. secondly, I had the opportunity to have this the preserve, protect, and enhance language in the Game and Fish Bill that passed and put it on the ballot. And one of the things that encouraged me to have that, actually a bill originally authored by Representative Sertich, was the fact that the money would go to preserve, protect, and enhance. And I can't imagine the resources north of here, particularly to this state, not to diminish the southern resources, but getting infested with carp. And I think it fits perfectly with that mission. And lastly is if we don't really look
at that 20 million real hard, and it's going to happen. That flood where it gets 5 to 6 foot differential that they can jump happens every 7 years. I mean, the odds are that this year we're going to have a flood, and it's going to be within 2 or 3 feet, and they're going to jump over the darn thing, and there we'll sit. I mean, it's just going to be a risk that we'll have to take. But if we wait 2 years, we've essentially doubled the risk, or even possibly more than that. So I think that's how important this is, and I think we should move at flank speed to find a solution.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Representative Drazkowski, and then I'm going to ask the DNR to come down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. You know, I agree with Representative Dill. The Constitution, as it's written around the use of these legacy dollars, this is exactly the type of thing that you're supposed to use that for, rather than continuing to purchase land in this state. So if we are going to do it, I think that's exactly the place it needs to come from. One question I would just leave everybody with is, what happens when, you know, people do things? What happens when somebody takes a bucket of carp and drives up the road 10 miles to the upstream side of everything that's developed here and dumps them in for whatever motives they have? Did we just waste $13 million? Just a question. I don't have the answer, Mr. Chair.
Good question, though. Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm having a bill drafted to prevent malicious transport, and we'll be looking for Representative Drazkowski to co-author that.
Well,
Ms. Taylor's working on it already.
Representative Hansen, you said to prevent it. I would imagine it will be to penalize those that do such a stupid thing. Unfortunately, I wish we could prevent it. Mr. Hirsch, if you could come down, and Mr. Skinner, I don't know if you're coming with. We have not had an opportunity to hear your comment on the presentation made. If you could specifically talk about, I believe Commissioner Landwehr said he's interested in moving forward to look at the possibilities of an RFP. I think specifically, can you address Representative Canoe's question about how an open RFP for millions of dollars would be done with the DNR to be sure that we had integrity in an open bidding system and such in the process? And any general comments, you've got about 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Steve Hirsch, Director of DNR Ecological and Water Resources. And just a couple of things I'd like to talk about very quickly. First of all, the DNR agrees that electricity is a better technology at stopping the fish than sound bubble barrier. The concern all along with electricity has been the safety issue, and I'll get to that in a second. Second of all, we have already been in discussions with the Corps about timing and how this would all work and what their process is. I think we have to keep in mind that the Corps controls these locks and dams, and so we have to go through their process. We actually had a meeting earlier this week and talked about the process we would go through. Their time estimate is about, excuse me, it's about a 6-month process, although they are very, very much on board with working with us and have indicated that they will try to expedite that and make that quicker if they can. But we are looking at probably something on the lines of, you know, 6 months, maybe a little bit less, to go through their process for approval. Safety with electricity remains one of their number one concerns, and they would have to be convinced that Mr. Griffin's claims that these were totally safe were true before they would go ahead and allow something like this. They're particularly concerned about recreational boat traffic that goes through the locks. They're not as concerned about the commercial barges, because you can take precautions with them, have rules and regulations that the commercial barges adhere to when they go through. But as we all know, the recreational boat traffic is a little bit more difficult to manage, and so that remains their number one issue. With regard to an RFP, there seems like there's maybe two different directions we could go here. We could do an RFP and somebody deliver a proposal for the best technology and not limit it necessarily to electricity. See what people come in with electricity, see what people come in with sound bubbles. The reality is, my understanding is it's a sole source vendor in either case. Smith Root is basically the vendor that installs electrical barriers, and then I think it's Ovivo is the vendor that installs sound bubble barriers. I think they may be the only two vendors that do that, so it may make more sense to really decide on the technology we want to use instead of going through an RFP process and then doing a sole source vendor justification, which there is a process for in state procurement. So to me, it seems like the best first step might be for Mr. Griffin or Smith Root to get together with the Corps and convince them, at least preliminarily, that this can be done safely as a lock, because right now they're not saying no, they're willing to consider it, but right now they're just not convinced that that's the case. And then if we can get to that point and the Corps says, okay, yeah, it looks like we can maybe do this, then we could start the process, what they call their Section 408 process, go through that, you know, get basically the permit we need to do this, and then basically go forward with the project. And so we did have a meeting with them earlier this week. Next week we're going to be meeting with them again. They're going to be bringing in their technical experts from Chicago. The Chicago district has more experience with electricity and barriers in general because they've been doing all that work in the Chicago area. This district, not as much, so they're going to be looking to the Chicago district for guidance there. And so I think those were the main things. I just wanted to reiterate that the core really is in control here on what happens with the locks, and we need to keep that in mind. The other thing is we do prefer electricity, but in any appropriation language that goes forward, it may be better to leave it to not specify electric, because if we do run into a dead end with electric, we would have the opportunity to go with the next best thing. And then another important thing is we don't just need dollars for construction. We need dollars for operation and maintenance, and we also need dollars for evaluation to see if these things are working. If we end up with sound bubble technology, we're going to need probably a backup technology in the lock chamber, something like the water cannons that they've been testing, that would help mitigate the fact that the sound bubble barriers aren't 100%. And so we need dollars for more than just the installation. So any appropriation, it would be very helpful if the dollars were available until expended instead of having the usual 1 to 2 year time frame. And
well, Director Hirsch, if I may, just because we're going to wrap up.
Okay.
Thank you. I expect this group to have serious discussions. I don't expect us, at least I would not support us moving forward, to spend tens of millions of dollars on bubble technology based on what I've been hearing. But we're going to have that discussion here. And just to clarify, where there may only be one manufacturer of a specific product, it's not unusual for competitive bids. For the contractor that will do this work, probably wouldn't be the Smith Root Company or the Bubble Company. General contractors used to working in lock and dams and removing concrete and stuff like that would be the kind of folks bidding on this work. And there's a very competitive environment out right now for those kinds of people to do the work, whereas it's not unusual to have an open competitive bid process and identify that what you're bidding on is to install a specific product. My familiarity with that was we could bid as a former landscape contractor, bid to build a playground, and they would identify the type of playground equipment they wanted to have put in, but you would have a very competitive bid among a number of contractors knowing they had to use a specific kind of equipment. So that, and Director Hirsch, you've mentioned that. I also think I heard you say you understand if the legislature decides to go with specific type, that as opposed to leaving it open-ended. I think that we have that. I would ask that when you drive from here, it sounds like you're not going with the Corps today, that meeting's not happening, but I would encourage Mr. Griffin to be part of the discussion and whoever else needs to be with the Corps, as we've all said here, that's a very important event. Members, thanks for the very good questions today. This is very important. I appreciate the bipartisan approach in looking at this and the openness of wondering where this money could come from. Representative Fabian, could you move the minutes from our previous meeting?
So moved.
Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes pass. The meeting's adjourned.